listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm David Watts Barton. In a moment, we'll be listening to Glenn Houston, the guitarist, but right now, my guest is David Williams, who has traveled all over the world searching for and preserving plant species, particularly native foods that are in danger of disappearing. He is currently working in Rome with the Rome-based Bioversity International, and he's in our area for the Harlan II International Symposium at UC Davis. David Williams, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, David. I'm glad to be here.
So what was going on? What is the Harlan II International Symposium at UC Davis that's happened this week?
Well, actually, this is the second symposium that has taken place in honor of Jack Harlan, who was a very famous plant explorer and a student of plant domestication. And this second symposium is taking place 10 or actually 11 years after the first one, which was took place in Aleppo, Syria, in one of the world centers of crop domestication. And this one, I think it's appropriate that it takes place at the University of California at Davis, which is also a world-renowned center of plant sciences and studies in plant domestication. And prominent archaeologists and geneticists and plant breeders and plant scientists and students of plant domestication came to the symposium and presented the most recent results of their studies in an effort to further our understanding of plant domestication.
And plant domestication happened about 10,000 years ago, at least in the Middle East, in Syria, in the Fertile Crescent that we've grown up with. Did it happen all over the world at the same time, as far as you know? Is it hard to tell, or how did that work?
No, actually, we know with greater and greater precision that, it did take place independently at different places around the world, probably 5 to 7 different what we call centers of origin of agriculture around the world because of the archaeological record. And as techniques improve, they're able to know with better and better precision not only when these plants and animals, I should say, were domesticated, but exactly we're understanding more and more how that process actually came about, where wild plants were converted into crop plants through the activity of humans as they transition from being hunters and gatherers to incipient farmers. And in those places where agriculture got started, it enabled greater densities of populations, small cities began to form, and civilization formed. So it's no coincidence that in those same centers of crop domestication and origins of agriculture are also the cradles of civilization.
And at the beginning, there were just a few plants that were domesticated, I take it, and then more and more as time went by.
Well, actually, most of the plants, practically all of the plants that we consume today, crop plants, plants and animals, were all domesticated, you know, between 7 and 10,000 years ago, by and large, in those same centers of origin, places in the world, which include the Fertile Crescent, parts of Southeast Asia, Middle America, Mexico, and Guatemala, and the Andean region are some of the better known of these centers of origin. And those are also places, cradles of agriculture and cradles of civilization, where farming communities enabled great densities of human populations and freed up a lot of people to get involved in religion, science, culture, and politics, and enabled modern civilization to occur. But really, all of the crops that we have today were all domesticated in prehistoric times. And that's one of the reasons why it's so interesting and so important that we understand this domestication process, because we are stuck with those same crops that feed our hugely increased populations today and continuing to grow. And to make those same crops continue to produce more, to be resistant to diseases, to be adapted to climate change, we need to understand these processes, evolutionary processes, which brought these crop species into existence in the first place, so that we can continue to kind of direct their evolution and continue to improve them.
Mm-hmm. Now, over those 7 to 10,000 years since, have they basically stayed the same? And in the last 100 years, we've started to modify plants. Are they domestication is a form of modifying?
Absolutely. It's a form of genetic modification. There's no question about it. All crop plants are genetically modified by it's beginning with those incipient farmers. And it continues up to this day. And all, even modern crop improvement, plant breeding, is simply directed evolution that directed by plant breeders and by farmers. And so, yes, the process continues, and no, the crops are not exactly the same as they were when they were first domesticated 7 to 10,000 years ago.
Just like there are more species of dogs than there were 10,000 years ago.
Well, dogs is a good example, and we had a very interesting expert on dog evolution and dog domestication speak at this symposium, because dogs are a great example of how one species, all dogs, pertain to the same species. Mm-hmm. That was domesticated. It's now been essentially proven that they all descended from the gray wolf. They're domesticated result of the domesticated wolf. And they all are interfertile. They can all produce offspring. All the different breeds, from Chihuahuas to Mastiffs, are all perfectly within the same biological species. But all of that diversity was a product of human selection. And that's what happens with crops, too. You have within a single crop species, maize, for example, corn, there are 300 different primitive varieties, or what we call land races of corn, known, that vary tremendously from tiny little ears that look like a strawberry to enormous ears that are 2 feet long. And these were all selected by, before modern crop plant breeding came into being, these were all developed by subsistence agriculturalists around, well, throughout the Americas, before it was diffused to the rest of the world.
From the maize equivalent of the gray wolf.
Yes.
So we've expanded over the last 10,000 years. We humans have greatly expanded the diversity of crops. Now the concern, though, is through what, corporate agriculture, or through commercial agriculture, we're starting to narrow the diversity of crops, and that's why you're trying to preserve the diversity?
That's one of the reasons. Extensive agriculture tends to look for more uniform crops, and a more uniform crop, you have larger and larger fields with more and more uniform plants. Every single individual is essentially nearly identical to the next. And so extensive plantations, extensive plantings of improved varieties tend to replace the more diverse local varieties that used to be grown in a given location. So what we are trying to do is to conserve those local varieties in seed banks, or gene banks, we call them, so that they will not be completely lost, and that genetic diversity can be conserved, characterized, and made available to plant breeders who, some of those local varieties, even though they may not be as high yielding as what is today's improved variety, may be resistant to a disease that hasn't even appeared yet. And so we can always go back to the gene bank and test those different varieties and see which ones are adapted to, say, the new disease or to the new changing climate. It basically provides us with as many options as we can possibly conserve to respond to the uncertain future that has always been a part of farming and agriculture. Uh-huh. We never can tell what the weather is going to be like.
And the weather has changed over those millennia, and farmers have responded to that in different ways. And this is sort of a more high-tech version of doing the same thing. Now, you have traveled a lot. You've been all over, particularly Latin America, it sounds like. And now you go out into remote areas and look for different kinds of corn or beans or whatever you're looking for?
Well, that's how I started out in my career as a plant explorer, a plant collector, going to generally the most remote parts of the world where examples of these different local varieties hadn't yet been collected. And then also we pay a lot of attention to the wild relatives, closely related wild relatives of crops, because in many instances, those closely related wild species can transfer important genes for, say, drought resistance or disease resistance or early maturing, or different traits can be transferred from those wild relatives to the crop through conventional breeding methods, and are useful as genetic resources for crop improvement.
I'm curious, when you were doing that, it sounds like you're not doing that so much now. You're doing more research or more work with...
Well, now I do more. Now I help coordinate a program that joins together all of the 15 different international agricultural research centers that have gene banks where the diversity, the world collections of crop diversity are maintained. Mm-hmm. As they're maintained in trust for the public. These are global public goods that are not, they're certainly not owned by these centers. They're just cared for, and under an agreement that we have with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, we make these materials available to anyone who can use them in for crop improvement or for planting directly in their countries.
So it's a sort of public domain.
Absolutely.
Of plant life, as opposed to companies now that are trying to copyright or trademark certain, I guess, copyright?
Well, they, in different ways, they patent or, mm-hmm. or register varieties, so they have they claim intellectual property over those mm-hmm. varieties. And for many improved varieties, that's the way seed companies can recover their investment.
And is that, does as a scientist, is that a legitimate thing to you, do you think?
Certainly, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do, in fact, spend a lot of money to develop these improved varieties that farmers, in turn, can purchase and grow and make a very handsome profit mm-hmm. because they are, in fact, improved. Mm-hmm. And they do very well, especially if you have all of the irrigation and fertilizer, and you can sort of control the conditions. But they don't work so well for poor farmers in developing countries that don't have access to mechanization, tractors, and irrigation, and chemical fertilizer. So what the kind of work that I do and we do in the International Agricultural Research Centers is our work is primarily focused on poor farmers in the developing world, and to our mission is to combat poverty and conserve agricultural biodiversity and protect the environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me. It's really interesting stuff, and enjoy your trip back to Rome.
Thank you very much.